feeling inexplicably reluctant to say it, and said instead, "Whom I have lost." "I'm showing you all the men whom I have taken away from you," he answered firmly. This was the root, she thought, of the guiltlessness of his face. He had guessed and named the words she had wanted to spare him. He had rejected a good will that was not based on his values. And in proud certainty of being right, he had made a boast of that which she had intended as an accusation. Ahead of them she saw a wooden pier projecting into the water of the lake. A young woman lay stretched on the sun-flooded planks, watching a battery of fishing rods. She glanced up at the sound of the car, then leaped to her feet in a single swift movement, a shade too swift, and ran to the road. She wore slacks, rolled above the knees of her bare legs. She had dark, disheveled hair and large eyes. Galt waved to her. "Hello, John. When did you get in?" she called. "This morning," he answered, smiling and driving on. Dagny jerked her head to look back, and saw the glance with which the young woman stood looking after Galt. And even though hopelessness, serenely accepted, was part of the worship in that glance, she experienced a feeling she had never known before, a stab of jealousy. "Who is that?" she asked. "Our best fishwife. She provides the fish for Hammond's grocery market."
"What else is she?"
"You've noticed that there's a what else for every one of us here?" "She's a writer, the kind of writer who wouldn't be published outside. She believes that when one deals with words, one deals with the mind." The car turned into a narrow path, climbing steeply into a wilderness of brush and pine trees. She knew what to expect when she saw a handmade sign nailed to a tree with an arrow pointing the way. The Buena Esperanza Pass. It was not a pass. It was a wall of laminated rock with a complex chain of pipes, pumps, and valves climbing like a vine up its narrow ledges. But it bore on its crest a huge wooden sign, and the proud violence of the letters announcing their message to an impassable tangle of ferns and pine branches was more characteristic, more familiar than the words. Wyatt Oil. It was oil that ran in a glittering curve from the mouth of a pipe into a tank at the foot of the wall, as the only confession of the tremendous secret struggle inside the stone, as the unobtrusive purpose of all the intricate machinery. But the machinery did not resemble the installations of an oil derrick, and she knew that she was looking at the unborn secret of the Buena Esperanza Pass. She knew that this was oil drawn out of shale by some method men had considered impossible. Ellis Wyatt stood on a ridge watching the glass dial of a gauge embedded in the rock. He saw the car stopping below and called, "Hi, Dagny. Be with you in a minute." There were two other men working with him, a big muscular roughneck at a pump halfway up the wall, and a young boy by the tank on the ground. The young boy had blonde hair and a face with an unusual purity of form. She felt certain that she knew this face, but she could not recall where she had seen it. The boy caught her puzzled glance, grinned, and, as if to help her, whistled softly, almost inaudibly, the first notes of Halley's Fifth Concerto. It was the young brakeman of the Comet. She laughed. "It was the Fifth Concerto by Richard Halley, wasn't it?" "Sure," he answered. "But do you think I'd tell that to a scab?"
"A what?"
"What am I paying you for?" asked Ellis Wyatt, approaching. The boy chuckled, darting back to seize the lever he had abandoned for a moment. "It's Miss Taggart who couldn't fire you if you loafed on the job."
"I can."
"That's one of the reasons why I quit the railroad, Miss Taggart," said the boy. "Did you know that I stole him from you?" said Wyatt. "He used to be your best brakeman, and now he's my best grease monkey. But neither one of us is going to hold him permanently."
"Who is?"
"Richard Halley. Music. He's Halley's best pupil." She smiled. "I know. This is a place where one employs nothing but aristocrats for the lousiest kinds of jobs." "They're all aristocrats, that's true," said Wyatt, "because they know that there's no such thing as a lousy job, only lousy men who don't care to do it." The roughneck was watching them from above, listening with curiosity. She glanced up at him. He looked like a truck driver, so she asked, "What were you outside? A professor of comparative philology, I suppose?"
"No, ma'am," he answered. "I was a truck driver." He added, "But that's not what I wanted to remain."
Ellis Wyatt was looking at the place around them with a kind of youthful pride, eager for acknowledgement. It was the pride of a host at a formal reception in a drawing room, and the eagerness of an artist at the opening of his show in a gallery. She smiled and asked, pointing at the machinery, "Shale oil?" "Uh-huh." "That's the process which you were working to develop while you were on Earth?" She said it involuntarily, and she gasped a little at her own words. He laughed. "While I was in hell, yes. I'm on Earth now." "How much do you produce?" 200 barrels a day." A note of sadness came back into her voice. "It's the process by which you once intended to fill 5 tank trains a day." "Dagny," he said earnestly, pointing at his tank, "1 gallon of it is worth more than a trainful back there in hell, because this is mine, all of it, every single drop of it, to be spent on nothing but myself." He raised his smudged hand, displaying the greasy stains as a treasure, and a black drop on the tip of his finger flashed like a gem in the sun. "Mine," he said. "Have you let them beat you into forgetting what that word means, what it feels like? You should give yourself a chance to relearn it." "You're hidden in a hole in the wilderness," she said bleakly, "and you're producing 200 barrels of oil, when you could have flooded the world with it." "What for? To feed the looters?" "No, to earn the fortune you deserve. But I'm richer now than I was in the world. What's wealth but the means of expanding one's life? There's 2 ways one can do it, either by producing more or by producing it faster. And that's what I'm doing. I'm manufacturing time."
"What do you mean?"
"I'm producing everything I need. I'm working to improve my methods, and every hour I save is an hour added to my life. It used to take me 5 hours to fill that tank. It now takes 3. The 2 I saved are mine, as pricelessly mine as if I move my grave 2 hours further away for every 5 I've got. It's 2 hours released from one task to be invested in another, 2 more hours in which to work, to grow, to move forward. That's the savings account I'm hoarding. Is there any sort of safety vault that could protect this account in the outside world?"
"But what space do you have for moving forward? Where's your market?"
He chuckled. "Market? I now work for use, not for profit. My use, not the looter's profit. Only those who add to my life, not those who devour it, are my market. Only those who produce, not those who consume, can ever be anybody's market. I deal with the life-givers, not with the cannibals. If my oil takes less effort to produce, I ask less of the men to whom I trade it for the things I need. I add an extra span of time to their lives with every gallon of my oil that they burn. And since they're men like me, they keep inventing faster ways to make the things they make, so every one of them gains me an added minute, hour, or day with the bread I buy from them, with the clothes, the lumber, the metal." He glanced at Galt. "An added year with every month of electricity I purchase. That's our market, and that's how it works for us. But that was not the way it worked in the outer world. Down what drain were they poured out there? Our days, our lives, and our energy into what bottomless, featureless sewer of the unpaid for? Here we trade achievements, not failures, values, not needs. We're free of one another, yet we all grow together. Wealth, Dagny? What greater wealth is there than to own your life and to spend it on growing? Every living thing must grow. It can't stand still. It must grow or perish. Look." He pointed at a plant fighting upward from under the weight of a rock. "A long, gnarled stem, contorted by an unnatural struggle, with drooping yellow remnants of unformed leaves, and a single green shoot thrust upward to the sun with the desperation of a last, spent, inadequate effort. That's what they're doing to us back there in hell. Do you see me submitting to it?"
"No," she whispered.
"Do you see him submitting?" He pointed at Galt.
"God, no."
"Then don't be astonished by anything you see in this valley." She remained silent when they drove on. Galt said nothing. On a distant mountainside in the dense green of a forest, she saw a pine tree slanting down suddenly, tracing a curve like the hand of a clock, then crashing abruptly out of sight. She knew that it was a man-made motion.
"Who's the lumberjack around here?" she asked.
"Ted Nielsen."
The road was relaxing into wider curves and gentler grades, among the softer shapes of hillsides.
She saw a rust-brown slope patched by two squares of unmatching green, the dark, dusty green of potato plants, and the pale greenish silver of cabbages. A man in a red shirt was riding a small tractor cutting weeds.
"Who's the cabbage tycoon?" she asked.
"Roger Marsh."
She closed her eyes. She thought of the weeds that were climbing up the steps of a closed factory, over its lustrous tile front, a few hundred miles away beyond the mountains. The road was descending to the bottom of the valley. She saw the roofs of the town straight below, and the small shining spot of the dollar sign in the distance at the other end. Galt stopped the car in front of the first structure on a ledge above the roofs, a brick building with a faint tinge of red trembling over its smokestack. It almost shocked her to see so logical a sign as Stockton Foundry above its door. When she walked, leaning on her cane, out of the sunlight into the dank gloom of the building, the shock she felt was part sense of anachronism, part homesickness. This was the industrial East, which in the last few hours had seemed to be centuries behind her. This was the old, the familiar, the loved sight of reddish billows rising to steel rafters, of sparks shooting in sunbursts from invisible sources, of sudden flames streaking through a black fog, of sand molds glowing with white metal. The fog hid the walls of the structure, dissolving its size, and for a moment, this was the great, dead foundry at Stockton, Colorado. It was Nielsen Motors. It was Reardon Steel.
"Hi, Dagny."
The smiling face that approached her out of the fog was Andrew Stockton's, and she saw a grimy hand extended to her with a gesture of confident pride, as if it held all of her moment's vision on its palm. She clasped the hand.
"Hello," she said softly, not knowing whether she was greeting the past or the future.
Then she shook her head and added, "How come you're not planting potatoes or making shoes around here? You've actually remained in your own profession?"
"Oh, Calvin Atwood of the Atwood Light and Power Company of New York City is making the shoes. Besides, my profession is one of the oldest and the most immediately needed anywhere. Still, I had to fight for it. I had to ruin a competitor first."
"What?" He grinned and pointed to the glass door of a sun-flooded room.
"There's my ruined competitor," he said.
She saw a young man bent over a long table, working on a complex model for the mold of a drill head. He had the slender, powerful hands of a concert pianist, and the grim face of a surgeon concentrating on his task.
"He's a sculptor," said Stockton. "When I came here, he and his partner had a sort of combination hand forge and repair shop. I opened a real foundry and took all their customers away from them. The boy couldn't do the kind of job I did. It was only a part-time business for him anyway. Sculpture is his real business. So he came to work for me. He's making more money now in shorter hours than he used to make in his own foundry. His partner was a chemist, so he went into agriculture, and he's produced a chemical fertilizer that's doubled some of the crops around here. Did you mention potatoes? Potatoes in particular."
"Then somebody could put you out of business, too."
"Sure, any time. I know one man who could, and probably will when he gets here. But boy, I'd work for him as a cinder sweeper. He'd blast through this valley like a rocket. He'd triple everybody's production."
"Who's that?"
"Hank Reardon."
"Yes," she whispered. "Oh, yes." She wondered what had made her say it with such immediate certainty. She felt simultaneously that Hank Reardon's presence in this valley was impossible, and that this was his place, peculiarly his. This was the place of his youth, of his start, and together the place he had been seeking all his life, the land he had struggled to reach, the goal of his tortured battle. It seemed to her that the spirals of flame-tinged fog were drawing time into an odd circle. And while a dim thought went floating through her mind like the streamer of an unfollowed sentence, "To hold an unchanging youth is to reach at the end the vision with which one started," she heard the voice of a tramp in a diner saying, "John Galt found the fountain of youth, which he wanted to bring down to men, only he never came back, because he found that it couldn't be brought down." A sheaf of sparks went up in the depth of the fog, and she saw the broad back of a foreman whose arm made the sweeping gesture of a signal, directing some invisible task. He jerked his head to snap an order. She caught a glimpse of his profile, and she caught her breath. Stockton saw it,
chuckled, and called into the fog.
Hey, Ken, come here. Here's an old friend of yours.
She looked at Ken Daniger as he approached them, the great industrialist, whom she had tried so desperately to hold to his desk, was now dressed in smudged overalls.
Hello, Miss Taggart. I told you we'd soon meet again.
Her head dropped as if in assent and in greeting, but her hand bore down heavily upon her cane for a moment while she stood reliving their last encounter, the tortured hour of waiting, then the gently distant face at the desk and the tinkling of a glass-paneled door closing upon a stranger. It was so brief a moment that two of the men before her could take it only as a greeting. But it was at Galt that she looked when she raised her head, and she saw him looking at her as if he knew what she felt. She saw him seeing in her face the realization that it was he who had walked out of Daniger's office that day. His face gave her nothing in answer. It had that look of respectful severity with which a man stands before the fact that the truth is the truth. I didn't expect it, she said softly to Daniger. I never expected to see you again. Daniger was watching her as if she were a promising child he had once discovered, and was now affectionately amused to watch.
I know, he said. But why are you so shocked?
Oh, it's just that it's preposterous. She pointed at his clothes.
What's wrong with it?
Is this then the end of your road?
Hell no, the beginning.
What are you aiming at?
Mining. Not coal, though. Iron.
Where?
He pointed toward the mountains. Right here. Did you ever know Midas Mulligan to make a bad investment? You'd be surprised what one can find in that stretch of rock if one knows how to look. That's what I've been doing. Looking.
And if you don't find any iron ore?
He shrugged. There's other things to do. I've always been short on time in my life, never on what to use it for.
She glanced at Stockton with curiosity. Aren't you training a man who could become your most dangerous competitor?
That's the only sort of men I like to hire, Dagny. Have you lived too long among the looters? Have you come to think that one man's ability is a threat to another?
Oh, no. But I thought I was almost the only one left who didn't think that.
Any man who's afraid of hiring the best ability he can find is a cheat who's in a business where he doesn't belong. To me, the foulest man on earth, more contemptible than a criminal, is the employer who rejects men for being too good. That's what I've always thought, and... Say, what are you laughing at?
She was listening to him with an eager, incredulous smile.
It's so startling to hear, she said, because it's so right.
What else can one think?
She chuckled softly. You know, when I was a child, I expected every businessman to think it.
And since then?
Since then I've learned not to expect it.
But it's right, isn't it?
I've learned not to expect the right.
But it stands to reason, doesn't it?
I've given up expecting reason.
That's what one must never give up, said Ken Daniger.
They had returned to the car and had started down the last ascending curves of the road when she glanced at Galt, and he turned to her at once as if he had expected it. It was you in Daniger's office that day, wasn't it? She asked.
Yes.
Did you know then that I was waiting outside?
Yes.
Did you know what it was like? To wait behind that closed door? She could not name the nature of the glance with which he looked at her. It was not pity, because she did not seem to be its object. It was the kind of glance with which one looks at suffering. But it was not her suffering that he seemed to be seeing.
Oh, yes, he answered quietly,
almost lightly. The first shop to rise by the side of the valley's single street was like the sudden sight of an open theater, a frame box without front wall, its stage set in the bright colors of a musical comedy, with red cubes, green circles, gold triangles, which were bins of tomatoes, barrels of lettuce, pyramids of oranges, and a spangled backdrop where the sun hit shelves of metal containers. The name on the marquee said, Hammond Grocery Market. A distinguished man in shirt sleeves, with a stern profile and gray temples, was weighing a chunk of butter for an attractive young woman who stood at the counter, her posture light as a showgirl's, the skirt of her cotton dress swelling faintly in the wind like a dance costume. Dagny smiled involuntarily, even though the man was Lawrence Hammond. The shops were small one-story structures, and as they moved past her, she caught familiar names on their signs, like headings on the pages of a book riffled by the car's motion. Mulligan General Store, Atwood Leather Goods, Nielsen Lumber. Then the sign of the dollar, above the door of a small brick factory with the inscription, Mulligan Tobacco Company. Who is the company besides Midas Mulligan? She asked. Dr. Axton, he answered. There were few passers-by, some men, fewer women, and they walked with purposeful swiftness, as if bound on specific errands. One after another they stopped at the side of the car, they waved to Galt, and they looked at her with the unastonished curiosity of recognition. Have I been expected here for a long time? She asked. You still are, he answered. On the edge of the road she saw a structure made of glass sheets held together by a wooden framework. But for one instant it seemed to her that it was only a frame for the painting of a woman, a tall, fragile woman with pale blonde hair, and a face of such beauty that it seemed veiled by distance, as if the artist had been merely able to suggest it, not to make it quite real. In the next instant, the woman moved her head, and Dagny realized that there were people at the tables inside the structure, that it was a cafeteria, that the woman stood behind the counter, and that she was Kay Ludlow, the movie star, who once seen could never be forgotten, the star who had retired and vanished 5 years ago to be replaced by girls of indistinguishable names and interchangeable faces. But at the shock of the realization, Dagny thought of the sort of movies that were now being made, and then she felt that the glass cafeteria was a cleaner use for Kay Ludlow's beauty than a role in a picture glorifying the commonplace for possessing no glory. The building that came next was a small squat block of rough granite, sturdy, solid, neatly built, the lines of its rectangular bulk as severely precise as the creases of a formal garment. But she saw, like an instant's ghost, the long streak of a skyscraper rising into the coils of Chicago's fog. The skyscraper that had once borne the sign she now saw written in gold letters above a modest pinewood door. Mulligan Bank. Galt slowed the car while moving past the bank, as if placing the motion in some special italics. A small brick structure came next, bearing the sign Mulligan Mint. A mint? She asked. What's Mulligan doing with a mint? Galt reached into his pocket and dropped two small coins into the palm of her hand. They were miniature discs of shining gold, smaller than pennies, the kind that had not been in circulation since the days of Nat Taggart. They bore the head of the Statue of Liberty on one side, the words, United States of America, $1, on the other. But the dates stamped upon them were of the past 2 years. That's the money we use here, he said. It's minted by Midas Mulligan. But on whose authority? That's stated on the coin, on both sides of it. What do you use for small change? Mulligan mints that too in silver. We don't accept any other currency in this valley. We accept nothing but objective values. She was studying the coins. This looks like something from the first morning in the age of my ancestors. He pointed at the valley. Yes, doesn't it? She sat looking at the two thin, delicate, almost weightless drops of gold in the palm of her hand, knowing that the whole of the Taggart transcontinental system had rested upon them, that this had been the keystone supporting all the keystones, all the arches, all the girders of the Taggart track, the Taggart bridge, the Taggart building. She shook her head and slipped the coins back into his hand. You're not making it easier for me, she said, her voice low. I'm making it as hard as possible. Why don't you say it? Why don't you tell me all the things you want me to learn? The gesture of his arm pointed at the town, at the road behind them. What have I been doing? He asked. They drove on in silence. After a while, she asked, in the tone of a dryly statistical inquiry, How much of a fortune has Midas Mulligan amassed in this valley? He pointed ahead. Judge for yourself. The road was winding through stretches of unleveled soil toward the homes of the valley. The homes were not lined along a street. They were spread at irregular intervals over the rises and hollows of the ground. They were small and simple, built of local materials, mostly of granite and pine, with a prodigal ingenuity of thought and a tight economy of physical effort.
Every house looked as if it had been put up by the labor of one man. No two houses were alike, and the only quality they had in common was the stamp of a mind grasping a problem and solving it. Galt pointed out a house once in a while, choosing the names she knew, and it sounded to her like a list of quotations from the richest stock exchange in the world, or like a roll call of honor. Ken Daniger, Ted Nielsen, Lawrence Hammond, Roger Marsh, Ellis Wyatt, Owen Kellogg, Dr. Axton. The home of Dr. Axton was the last. A small cottage with a large terrace lifted on the crest of a wave against the rising walls of the mountains. The road went past it and climbed on into the coils of an ascending grade. The pavement shrank to a narrow path between two walls of ancient pines, their tall straight trunks pressing against it like a grim colonnade, their branches meeting above, swallowing the path into sudden silence and twilight. There were no marks of wheels on the thin strip of earth. It looked unused and forgotten. A few minutes and a few turns seemed to take the car miles away from human habitation. And then there was nothing to break the pressure of the stillness but a rare wedge of sunlight cutting across the trunks in the depth of the forest once in a while. The sudden sight of a house on the edge of the path struck her like the shock of an unexpected sound. Built in loneliness, cut off from all ties to human existence, it looked like the secret retreat of some great defiance or sorrow. It was the humblest home of the valley, a log cabin, beaten in dark streaks by the tears of many rains, only its great windows withstanding the storms with the smooth, shining, untouched serenity of glass.
Whose houses?
Oh. She caught her breath and jerked her head away. Above the door, hit by a ray of sun, its design blurred and worn, battered smooth by the winds of centuries, hung the silver coat of arms of Sebastian d'Anconia. As if in deliberate answer to her involuntary movement of escape, Galt stopped the car in front of the house. For a moment they held each other's eyes. Her glance was a question, his a command. Her face had a defiant frankness, his an unrevealing severity. She understood his purpose, but not his motive. She obeyed. Leaning on her cane, she stepped out of the car, then stood erect, facing the house. She looked at the silver crest that had come from a marble palace in Spain to a shack in the Andes to a log cabin in Colorado, the crest of the men who would not submit. The door of the cabin was locked. The sun did not reach into the glazed darkness beyond the windows, and pine branches hung outstretched above the roof like arms spread in protection, in compassion, in solemn blessing. With no sound but the snap of a twig, or the ring of a drop falling somewhere in the forest, through long stretches of moments. The silence seemed to hold all the pain that had been hidden here, but never given voice. She stood listening with a gentle, resigned, unlamenting respect. Let's see who'll do greater honor, you to Nat Taggart, or I to Sebastian d'Anconia. Dagny, help me to remain, to refuse, even though he's right. She turned to look at Galt, knowing that he was the man against whom she had had no help to offer. He sat at the wheel of the car. He had not followed her or moved to assist her, as if he had wanted her to acknowledge the past and had respected the privacy of her lonely salute. She noticed that he still sat as she had left him, his forearm leaning against the wheel at the same angle, the fingers of his hand hanging down in the same sculptured position. His eyes were watching her, but that was all she could read in his face, that he had watched her intently, without moving. When she was seated beside him once more, he said, "That was the first man I took away from you." She asked,